I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's been a while since our friend Frank Byrne joined us, but the executive director of the Kansas City Symphony is a busy guy. He's carved out some time today to share with us the classical music he's been listening to lately and to walk us through a symphony by one of Russia's most prolific composers. Then to the literary history of Kansas City and a local connection to Ernest Hemingway. Learn about his time spent reporting for the Kansas City Star and how the Paris of the Plain shaped an 18-year-old Hemingway before going off to Europe and World War I. We'll bring you back to modern day with the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Frank Byrne, executive director of the Kansas City Symphony, hasn't been by for a while with his picks for some intriguing new classical music worth checking out. We're going to rectify that oversight right now as Frank joins us again. We're going to be talking quite a bit about a major Russian composer and pianist regarded as one of the seminal figures of 20th century music. That man is Dmitri Shostakovich. Frank Byrne, welcome back.
Hey, Steve. Great to be with you.
And congratulations on the successful fund drive.
Well, thank you
so
much.
A big moment for you, for the symphony, everybody else.
Absolutely. It's a great thing for the community, and we are very grateful to everyone who helped us reach that wonderful goal.
That's terrific. So why the big focus this time on Shostakovich?
Well, you know, we're going to start in the 18th century, and then we're going to move to the 20th century, and I'll talk a little bit more about Shostakovich later, but this is one of the great works of the orchestral repertoire and really one of the most significant compositions of the 20th century, but we're going to start back in the 18th century.
With Bach.
Absolutely.
Okay, I mean, tell us.
Well, you can never have too much Bach, and this is a wonderful recording just released on Deutsche Grammophon. It's Murray Pariah's first recording for this label, and he recorded the Bach French Suites. Now, this is a wonderful collection of dance movements that were written by Bach when he was in his late 30s. And it's played on a modern piano where you get the full range of dynamics that just are not possible on a harpsichord. And Pariah is a brilliant pianist. He has a really liquid technique that you'll hear in this excerpt that we're going to play.
I like that, Frank. It's liquid technique you just described.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
That's a nice way to describe it. Let's move on to Handel.
Well, we have two selections from Handel. The first is from one of his most well-known pieces, The Water Music. There are two suites of music from The Water Music, and everyone who loves classical music should own at least one recording of The Water Music. And I have to say, this new recording by a group called Zefiro is maybe the most exciting recording of this music that I have ever heard. Now, this excerpt, the Barret from the first suite, you've heard it on TV, you've heard it in the movies, but, you know, this is an amazing recording. It's like a finely tuned race car, and it's superbly recorded. And when you think about the musicianship that's invested in this short excerpt, wait until you hear the last note. Let's hear it.
Here's Zefiro. Never heard it like that before.
Yeah, that's real musicianship and a wonderful period instrument group. And wow, I mean, it's muscular, it's precise, so clean, just a thrill. So I think everyone will enjoy that recording. And on this same CD is also a set of water music by Telemann, which most people don't know. So that's a bonus.
Let's stay with Handel, and let's move to a track that has our own Joyce DiDonato.
Well, Joyce is, of course, a wonderful friend and such an amazing artist, and she put together this rather remarkable collection of music called In War and Peace, Harmony Through Music. And she recorded a bunch of arias from Baroque opera, and we're going to hear one from Handel's opera Rinaldo, written in 1711, and the aria we're going to hear is Lascia ch'io pianga, which means leave me to weep. And it is so gorgeous. You know, Handel can put the dots on the paper, but then you need someone to deliver the goods, and Joyce does it in such an amazing way. Let's hear it.
That's Prairie Village's own Joyce DiDonato. Where does she rank, Frank, in the pantheon of our great singers?
I have to say, Steve, honestly, and I don't say this just because she's our friend, she is at the tip top. And I'm talking about of singers that we know about in the last century. I mean, she is a wonderful singer, but she's also a fantastic actress. And on stage, or, you know, on a concert stage or on the opera stage, Joyce just has an ability to project her character and to deliver such stunning phrasing like you just heard. I mean, she is really one in a million.
Let's move on here to Shostakovich.
Well, you know, when you think about different styles of music, different character of music, if we make an analogy to literature, from the last selection we just heard to this, we're sort of going from Jane Austen to Tolstoy. And so an obviously very, very different piece. Shostakovich was one of the most important Russian composers of all time, but certainly the 20th century. And when he wrote his first four symphonies, he veered off from the traditional path. And it's like he, if he were a chef, he was starting to make nouvelle cuisine when what they wanted was borscht and stroganoff.
And he was ostracized for some
yes,
of it,
he
too.
Was. And he got on the wrong side of Stalin, which
yes.
was not a good place to be.
And so, I thought at one point that maybe he was going to bite it.
That's right.
Because I mean, not pleasing the great man.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. And so he, you know, was given very specific instructions that he had to change his style of composition. And that was really realized in this Fifth Symphony, which was kind of a turning point at that moment in his career. And, you know, a few days before this piece was premiered, there was a quote attributed to Shostakovich published in the Moscow newspaper that said that this symphony was, quote, a Soviet artist's creative response to justified criticism. Unquote. We don't know, of course, if Shostakovich ever really said that, but it was printed that way, you know, to sort of to do it so that it kept the narrative going about him being chastised and then responding. But here's the bottom line. It is a magnificent symphony. It's his most popular symphony. And this is a live recording of the Pittsburgh Symphony conducted by their music director, Manfred Honeck. And what I'm going to do, as I've done in the past, is take your listeners on a kind of guided tour of the piece, because we can't really get to know anything about the character of this music by hearing a 20-second excerpt. So we're going to hear a number of excerpts. We're going to start with the opening of the first movement and hear this dramatic jagged figure that starts, but within 30 seconds, it has evaporated into this kind of beautiful, serene, dreamy treatment. Let's hear the first excerpt.
Well, that's quite an about face.
It is. And I don't know that I can think of another symphony, not that there aren't, but I can't think of one right now where is this dramatic contrast like you've just heard. Mm-hmm. And of course, later in the first movement, just as part of the development of this idea, we have to have it come back with all the full weight of the orchestra and the brass. So let's hear later in the first movement.
Frank, can you just take a second and explain to our listeners just how challenging it is to write music for that many instruments with that kind of sound that we just heard?
Well, it takes a particular kind of musical imagination, and then the ability to translate that into something on paper that you know will begin to approximate what's in your head. And it's very, very difficult, and oftentimes composers will write something down, they'll hear it rehearsed, and they'll say, no, that's not quite it. Sort of like an author has an editor. There is really no analogous situation in composition where, you know, it goes through a whole staff of people. So there is often this evolution of a piece in performance where dynamics are adjusted, maybe scoring is adjusted. But it's really the biggest challenge is not just getting two incidental excerpts to on paper, but it is the architecture of a long, long piece of music and how it all connects together. Actually, the next excerpt we're going to hear from the beginning of the second movement is a variation of a theme that we heard in the first movement, and this movement is kind of a very satirical waltz, and it's so heavy when it starts out, it kind of reminds you of like waltzing elephants, and the horns come in, and it almost could be like a, you know, elephants trumpeting, you know, but it's meant to be humorous, and it's very very satirical. Let's hear the waltz.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visited by Frank Byrne, the executive director of the Kansas City Symphony. We're talking about the music of Shostakovich.
Now, in that excerpt we just heard, obviously we had a big boisterous opening, and then it came down to an almost classical chamber wind ensemble, mm-hmm. sort of like a Mozart wind serenade, something like that. But of course, later in the movement, it again comes back in this overblown version. So let's hear the next treatment of the second movement. So you get the idea of how that works. Now, in the third movement, we have a total change in mood into a very, very serene, dreamy movement here where there's no brass in this movement at all. There are these beautiful, long melodies. It's beautiful. It's rather melancholy. It's a work of genius. This is absolute genius. And, you know, it's said that when this was premiered, that audiences were weeping at how beautiful this was. Let's hear the beginning of the third movement. You know, it's almost hard to believe that the same person who wrote that satirical waltz we heard a few seconds ago could also create this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a little window into the psyche and the imagination of this great composer. Now, as this slow movement develops, which again is a really magnificent compositional accomplishment, it builds into a section that is so intense and so dramatic, and it's hard to convey in a short period of time, but we'll hear maybe the climax of this movement where you can begin to hear how this builds to a real moment of anguish and sort of an outpouring of emotion. Let's hear that. You know, one of the great things about music is that without the use of any words, it sort of speaks to our soul and to our inner being. And so you don't have to explain what does that mean. You feel through the way the melody is developed and the way he treats it. And it's one of the things that I think is very special about this piece. Well, now we're into the fourth movement,
right,
which some people conjecture is actually meant to be a sort of satirical portrait of Stalin in music. Now, I think on its own, it stands as a totally legitimate piece of music. It is not sarcastic in my book. But if you want to think about whether or not there are elements of this that are pompous or overblown, and you make a connection to this being some sort of very quiet thumbing of the nose at Stalin, you know, you could look at it that way, but on its own, it's a real work of genius.
Now, I bet Shostakovich never said that publicly at the time.
Right, of course. Well, if not, he would be in Siberia.
Yes, that's right.
So this is actually based on the march music that we saw in the climax of the first movement of this symphony. And when you hear this opening, which again, total contrast from what we just heard before in the third movement, this is like, you know, if you imagine, you turn your own imagination loose, this is a very muscular thing. This is the May Day parade with tanks rolling down the streets and all of the power of the great Soviet Union back under in that incredible time in its history. Let's hear the opening to the fourth movement.
Well, I can sort of hear that.
We're ramped up and we're going. But then, again, Shostakovich brings it down. And you will hear this ascending figure of the four notes like we heard at the opening of this movement. But it is totally transformed into this incredible, dreamy, suspended. It's like time is suspended. And then to me, this music sort of feels like you're floating, you know, in mm-hmm. water. Let's listen to this next excerpt from the fourth movement. So again, even in this movement, we have these contrasts, and this is incredibly beautiful. Now, of course, as this develops, we have to think about where the movement is going to end, and so we need a way to ramp it back up. Mm-hmm. And this next excerpt we'll hear, it's sort of like the sun is coming out. You know, we've had this moment of reflection, but now the sun's going to come out. We're going to see things begin to go back to the mood that we heard before. Let's hear the next one. Thank you.
And finally.
And now let's hear the very end of the last movement. All the big guns.
Well, that's the way to go out.
There you go.
There you go. That's Frank Byrne talking about the music of Shostakovich. And thanks, Frank. Thanks so much. We sure appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve. Always a pleasure.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, Steve Paul will visit with us about his new book about a very young Ernest Hemingway. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we took a tour of the historic structures of Kansas City and got tips for effective, correct use of kids' car seats. You can find those conversations at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we'll meet Lamont McIntyre, who was free after 23 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. Also, we want to hear about your most memorable Halloween costumes. Call us tomorrow and share your favorite ones. Well, Ernest Hemingway's legacy as among the great American authors is well known. Less known is his first professional writing job right here in Kansas City at the Kansas City Star. Hemingway didn't go to college, but he did spend 6 months in a crash course on writing and the real world as a cops reporter for the newspaper. Steve Paul has a new book out on Hemingway's 18th year that examines those months in Kansas City and his work on the Red Cross ambulance service in Italy. It was there 2 weeks before his 19th birthday where he was dangerously wounded at the front. Steve Paul's new book is Hemingway at 18, the pivotal year that launched an American legend. Steve spent more than 40 years at the Kansas City Star, including a stint as editor of the editorial page. He'll be appearing in Lawrence tonight. More on that in just a few minutes. Steve, so good to have you. Welcome back here.
Thanks for having me back, Steve. Appreciate it.
Ernest Hemingway's life has been sliced and diced in a way that few lives have. Why did you want to contribute one more book to Papa here?
Yeah, you know, for a long time, thinking about this book, doing research, you know, I never, I knew, oh, we don't need another book about Hemingway.
And you've read most of them.
And I have read most of them, and I'll get back to something in just a second, but it's about 12 years ago when I came across a letter, which I write about in the book, from a friend of Hemingway's to Hemingway. Hemingway was just leaving Kansas City. The friend had just moved on to St. Louis. And of all the assessments of Hemingway's talent or lack of talent, you know, by staff members of the Star who were interviewed, say, 30 years later, Tubby Williams gave this incredible testimony to his talent. You see things. You read people like a book. You know things. And above all, you can tell it. This was a comment to Hemingway based on stories he wrote, and that it was unprecedented, at least in my experience, in terms of assessing Kansas City's this Kansas City period. And so that gave me the sort of the confirmation that there was a story here to tell that really hadn't been told before in any kind of depth. As it turned out, I have other kind of new voices, and in the biography world, the idea of slice of life biography is kind of the current buzzword.
That's the
thing. I went to a conference last spring in Boston of biographers, and slice of life was the big word. And our friend Candace Millard
has made a career out of it.
Was held up as sort of the new gold standard in slice of life biographies. And I realize in looking at the fact that there are at least a dozen new books about Hemingway coming out this year alone. Mm. And I realized my book is the absolute sliciest. And I thought, there is potential in that. And again, people, I think, don't realize, you know, for a long time I thought this book was going to be Hemingway in Kansas City. That's the way I was framing it. And it was really only until late in the process that I had this kind of epiphany in which I realized, well, you know, nobody really cares about Kansas City, I mean, as a subject or as a background for Hemingway. But what would be a more universal kind of approach, I realized, my God, he's only 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Hemingway at 18, which kind of is so resonant, especially when you consider the fact that, as you mentioned, that allowed me to take the story to Italy, to his wounding 2 weeks before turning 19, and it just made much stronger sort of framework for telling this story.
Why did Ernest Hemingway even wind up in Kansas City?
Yeah, it's a pretty fairly well-known story, but it was not as simple as it sounds. Hemingway had an uncle in Kansas City who worked in the lumber business, but he had a friend, Henry Haskell, who was a top editor at the newspaper. Mm-hmm. They'd gone to Oberlin together, and Tyler Hemingway, the uncle, kept telling Hemingway, "I can get you a job." So Hemingway, and the book begins with sort of this sort of summer of indecision after Hemingway graduates from high school in Oak Park, Illinois. He, he's trying to figure out what to do with his life. He's not going to college. There's a long story associated with that. And he's up in Michigan, where he spent summers, every summer of his life up till that point, working the family farm acreage and hanging out with friends and trying to figure out, what am I going to do? Newspapering became kind of the thing, the target, mm-hmm. because he'd written for the high school paper. He'd met some people who encouraged him to go in that direction. He'd read a really compelling account of what it's like to be a journalist. And in the end, I think he finally decided, I think he was holding out to work in Chicago. His high school English teacher had written to a couple of the Chicago newspapers on his behalf. They both said, "We're not hiring." And he finally gave up and said, "Okay, I'll go to Kansas City."
And here he came.
And here he came. And I let me add, 100 years ago this week.
Is that right?
Yeah. So wow. Sunday, October 15th, was the day he arrives in Kansas City 100 years ago. 2 days ago, October 17th, was his first day in the newsroom.
Well, the newsroom, as I know firsthand, was a real testing ground for mm-hmm. young pups, mm-hmm. you know, and including Ernest Hemingway far earlier than when we first arrived. What was he assigned to do when he first got there?
Grunt stuff. You know, here, kid, see what you can do with this. Write some obits, which at the time were like 3 sentences long. there were, as I understand it, there were maybe 10 undertakers within walking distance from the Star, and he'd go visit and find out who died. There was a brief period when he says he's editing letters to the editor, you know, transcribing those and getting them ready for publication. So he does a lot of those sort of grunt tasks, and then increasingly gets assigned to do, you know, as you mentioned, some crime reporting, some feature writing. He was really eager to kind of prove himself, and he volunteered to work more than a day-long shift.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up doing a lot of kind of beat writing involving the General Hospital, which was under siege because of lack of funds, a smallpox epidemic, a meningitis epidemic. They only had 3 ambulances, and they were always breaking down. He covered that sort of tumbling problems at the hospital, to the point that the general manager of the hospital at one day apparently tried to throw him out. So he had all the he spent
in the grand tradition of reporters.
The spring of 1918, he's writing a lot about military recruiting of various kinds, going to those offices, writing these really interesting, really kind of fun narrative features about guys standing in line who want to join up. And join the war. So his experience was a lot more varied than has sort of been acknowledged before. There's this real sort of rudimentary story about what Hemingway learned in Kansas City, and then he went off. If biographers spend any time at all on this period, they only basically acknowledge, well, he learned how to write short sentences and,
that kind
of thing. But I think I go a little deeper than that.
Steve Paul's my guest. His new book, Hemingway at 18, The Pivotal Year That Launched an American Legend. Steve will be speaking about his book on Ernest Hemingway at 7 this evening at the Raven Bookstore. That's at 6 East 7th Street in Lawrence, downtown Lawrence. More information, ravenbookstore.com. You know, it was interesting to me, the Star didn't list bylines in those days. Mm-hmm. You know, who wrote the story, at the top of each story that told the reader some information. How difficult did it make it for you to determine, you know, which stories Hemingway had even written?
Well, at some point, actually as far back as the 60s, efforts were made by scholars and by star staffers
to piece that together. Yeah.
Yeah, to identify many of the stories that Hemingway wrote. And they're all kind of logical, and we go along with that. In addition to that, so I had, you know, a basis to start with. I spent a lot of time on microfilm reading the star almost every day of that 6.5 month period. Wow. I wasn't always looking for things he might have written, although I know I found some things that hadn't been acknowledged before. But I was also looking for context and the things he might be reading every day.
What was happening in town?
What's the, you know, the ethos? What's the background? What's, you know, what might Hemingway be learning about life while he's in Kansas City? So, you know, identifying those stories, there are some stories we know because he wrote to his parents or his sister and include clips. Here's something I did, you know, that kind of thing. And so a few of those turned up in letters as we know more and more about the letters that Hemingway wrote home. So just kind of a gathering string all over the place.
Now, we can debate forever what you just talked about, which is how much influence newspaper writing had on his style of writing.
Exactly.
These rules of writing that the Star emphasized back then and even today, writing concisely, no extraneous words, reach for the truth. How would you quantify the Star's impact on what he was able to produce later?
You know, Hemingway writes this incredible letter in mid-April. He's of 1918 to his father, and he's talking about how bushed he is, how much hard work he put into this, and how he wrote more and maybe even better than you know, many of the older men around him. But the thing about doing it is getting the names right and getting the facts right, and that was really, really hard to make sure that you're not you know, libeling somebody. And
Kraske, is it a street? Is it avenue? Is it circle? Let's get it right, Kraske. Come on.
Exactly. You and I have both been through that. And, you know, I've written my share of corrections. But
right.
But, and that cliche, use short sentences, use short first paragraphs. You know, Hemingway didn't always write short sentences, but, you know, he did quite a bit. And he learned from sitting with editors who were marking up his copy, you know, and maybe in some ways helping to shape his copy. One thing I think he learned, and I write about in several instances, is he might not have necessarily learned it, but he got to practice it in Kansas City, was the use of dialogue, narrative dialogue. Not just quoting somebody, but presenting a conversation as action. And that was something that comes up from time to time in various stories he wrote. So, you know, I think he learned quite a bit. There are other instances when he learned from, you know, a lot of the literary guys who were surrounding him. And, you know, there's a lot of book news in the paper and literary kind of features and writings by people who clearly have you know, a passion for literature, and I think in part, you know, Hemingway absorbed some of that.
You know, you also talk about the newsroom being full of characters back in those days. There was Popeyed Smith, the Beamer, Black Pants Hicks, the racy Todd Ormonston, known as the White Slaver, and Broken Bill Moorhead, known for his bad luck at the poker table. What's your sense of who influenced him the most? Those people aren't around anymore.
Yeah, those guys.
Looking for them. They're not there.
Well, you know, none of those guys, I think, were great influences on Hemingway. Although I did learn a little something. I think I'm pretty sure Hemingway played poker with Todd Ormonston. Maybe fairly frequently. I learned a story about Todd that comes up much later that I couldn't even tell you on the radio.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So, but
shoot.
Leave it at that.
Yeah.
But anyway, and not only the men around him. I mean, he gave nicknames. He was a joker and kind of a, you know, in some ways he was shy and reserved. In other ways, he was outgoing and could be boisterous. And, you know, all these aspects of his personality are clearly coming through. But as a way to kind of in part to maybe overcompensate for not having a college education, you know, he's boastful. He's, you know, he does hang out with these guys. and it really appreciates who they are. He wrote a story, and I mentioned this in the book. I was really hoping to be able to reprint it, but never got permission. He wrote an unpublished a story that has never been published that's set in Kansas City, and it's about a star reporter. It's clearly set in Kansas City. It's about a star reporter who decides to investigate a murder.
Mm.
And this portrait of this reporter is really kind of devastating because he's kind of the mediocre guy whose stuff you start reading and never read to the end, you know. And this portrait of this guy is really sad. But he goes on to, you know, take it upon himself to investigate this murder, and it's a really a kind of a Baroque thing. And he ends up, you know, succeeding. He ends up, you know, it. In a very odd way, not to give anything away, not that we'll ever read that story, but so he had, you know, and this is something that comes up much later in his life. You know that of all his friends in Paris, he ends up skewering all of them, you know, and in one way or another, especially when he writes his Movable Feast, you know, F. Scott Fitzgerald and
right.
Gertrude Stein, and you know, it's hard to say that he, you know, he certainly kept alive a few of the friendships from the star period, and I think he cherished those friendships, but he didn't necessarily maintain connections with some of the journalists who he got to know.
Steve Paul's my guest. His book, Hemingway at 18, the pivotal year that launched an American legend. So what did his colleagues think of him? Because we're always judging each other in the newsroom. What did they say about Hemingway?
I go through, as I mentioned before, so in, you know, a lot of that comes from interviews that were done by a Yale scholar in the early 1950s who got to Henry Haskell, got to a lot of the people who knew Hemingway in that period. And what they thought of him was, well, he's a nobody. He's, you know, he's this 18-year-old kid who comes in from the country, you know, suburban Chicago. He's apple-cheeked. He's kind of lanky. And, you know, if he showed any talent, you know, I don't quite remember it. You know, maybe he's promising, maybe he's not. But, you know, and you wonder, so when did it dawn on them some years later as Hemingway was gaining fame? Oh, this was the kid who I never paid attention to, you know, in 1918.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said earlier, there's Tubby Williams, who writes that letter and kind of hammers home this incredible talent that he saw in Hemingway. And to me, you know, he's the best testament to.
It's happened in my career, maybe yours too. You know, kids come into the newsroom. I call them kids, and you don't pay a lot of attention to them. Then you hear 5 years later they've gone off to the New York Times or something. You got to be kidding me.
For a lot of my career, you know, I mentored a lot of, you know, writers and reporters at the Star. And and a lot of them have, you know, went on to great jobs around the world. And, you know, it's kind of but you don't necessarily know that when you're sitting there, you know, editing their copy.
Yeah. Steve Paul's new book, Hemingway at 18, the pivotal year that launched an American legend. You can see and hear him tonight at 7 at the Raven Bookstore over in downtown Lawrence. Good luck with the book. Always good to have you here, Steve.
Thanks
Appreciate
so much,
it.
Steve.
You bet. Coming up, Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Brian McTavish is here to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekend. He's here. Janet Jackson, we're just listening to her. She's going to be here. Steve Paul from formerly of the Star is still here.
Woo.
Welcome back. How are you?
Woo!
It's like old home weekend here.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Janet Jackson is also here. Tickets.
And you can hear her brother in her music, can't you?
Well, you can.
You can.
I mean,
wow.
Well, first of all, let's get this out. 8 o'clock tonight.
Mm.
8 o'clock tonight. Get the weekend going.
Is it sold out?
No.
You can get a seat.
Sprint Center, downtown. Now, you mentioned Michael. Who knew? Nobody. When little Michael Jackson was setting the music industry on fire, that his even littler sister Janet would one day rise to the heights that she enjoys today.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like Ernest Hemingway rising up and later on his career after leaving the star.
Steve?
See, there's my analogy.
Steve, that's why.
I'm reaching.
That's why you're the host.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm bringing everything together here. Well, how about this? Two Steves and a Brian.
Yeah.
Yeah, you like that. Yeah. Brian likes that because his name comes at the end, always the part people remember. Okay, so Janet's working on several levels here. This is one of her classic tracks, Rhythm Nation, right? You can dance to it, but you can learn from it, right?
Oh.
So Janet wants
What would I learn?
No. Stick with me here.
Okay.
Janet wants you to listen up. She wants to get down with you, Steve, but...
No, she doesn't.
Yes, she does.
Yeah.
Musically, theatrically. She also wants to make a difference, and you're part of that difference. She's helping people stand up for themselves. She wants people to work together for positive change. She doesn't merely want to entertain us, Steve. She wants to inspire us to make the world a better place. And you can catch her.
She hired you as her flack, or what? Where's this coming from?
Oh,
here?
No.
Yeah.
Flack. I prefer to think of as friendly announcer of things happening. That's what I'm doing here.
That's
anyway,
what we're doing. Okay.
She wants to inspire us all, and so she shall. And I will say this. There are political, as you might suspect, overtones to her show. She has certain progressive viewpoints that, to be fair, everyone may not wholeheartedly agree with all the time. But we can all dance to it, Steve, and if we can dance to it, we can do other things.
Okay.
All right?
Well said.
Well done.
If everybody had an ocean across the USA, then everybody'd be surfing like California. You'd see them wearing their baggies.
Are they really going to be here? Is that a misprint? The Beach Boys are here?
Some of them. Well, okay.
Not all of them. Some of them.
You're the hardcore newsman.
Yes.
Okay, here we go. Just to satisfy your print curiosity.
Boundless curiosity.
Right, okay. Two guys that will mean something to longtime Beach Boys fan. The guy singing the song, Surfin' USA, the big hit from 1963 for the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
None other than Mike Love, wearing a cap for whatever reason he may never explain, or might seem obvious at his age. He will be there.
No kidding.
He will be there. Sunday night, 7 o'clock, Arvis Bank Theater at the Midland. Also on hand. On ham, did I say? Well, that's true enough. Also on hand in this current touring version of the Eternally Young Band will be longtime periodic Beach Boys member Brian Johnston, who since the 60s has been dipping in and out of the Beach Boys universe.
Mike Love is 76.
Is that right?
That's right.
I did not know that.
And he's still touring. That's incredible.
Well, yes, I once sat down with Mike Love, and he was a great guy, but he likes making a living, and we'll leave it at that. Anyway, the central image of this band, as expressed in this song, is an entire nation of teenagers cresting one big wave of never-ending summer fun.
So well said.
Say it with me. In your head, of course.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 iconic things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org.
Surf's up.
Who do we have here?
Well, let me just say, listeners, I just got the thumbs up from Steve Paul, so it's a go-to item. Okay, you ready? It's the old editor never wavers from being correct. It's all true. Okay, it's the B-52s, as we all know.
Those
new wave icons from another time, another place, another reason to put a smile on your face. 8 o'clock Sunday night. Uptown Theater.
So the Beach Boys are at 7 Sunday. The B-52s are 8 Sunday.
Yeah, so catch an hour of the Beach Boys.
What's a fan to do?
Go crazy and do both and brag to all of your friends. But very briefly, go ahead.
What flashed through my mind with the B-52s was many years ago experiencing a cocktail named after the B-52s.
Oh.
Lethal, but a really great night. Anyway.
And there, Steve, you have encapsulated the whole point of the band. And so they had two periods. One was that breakout period in the late 70s where they had such kind of relatively edgy, maniac party dance hits like Rock Lobster, Private Idaho, Dance This Mess Around. But this tune, Rome is part of that late 80s kind of comeback where they had Love Shack, this tune, Deadbeat Club, and those tunes really highlighted the vocals of Kate Pearson and Cindy Wilson, great intertwining lead singers. But don't worry, gang, Fred Schneider, that singer-talker guy, sort of the Rex Harrison of the new wave, he's part of the band. They'll be there. Some tickets remain. You might have to sit by yourself, but what, if you're at the B-52 show, you're never by yourself.
Here.
Well, actually, did you know that this month, and you don't know this, that's why I'm here,
yes,
this month would be the 100th birthday, and if I'm saying this wrong, Steve, feel free to chime in, Violetta Parra.
Oh, I knew that.
Did you know? Priceless. Okay. Once again, you're ganging up on me. Two against one.
If you didn't know that, there's something really wrong.
I'm terribly handicapped then, or I should say, in any event. KC Latin Jazz All-Stars are hosting a tribute concert to this historic voice, this historic force in Chilean folk artistry. 100th centennial of her birth, Violeta Parra. 100 years will be celebrated 7 o'clock Saturday at Prospero's.
It's hard being a host. It's hard.
Well, thank you for that.
Okay. And finally today, I just want to point out Greg Osby, for jazz heads out there, will be at the Black Dolphin at 18th and Grand at 9 o'clock Friday evening. He's a big name in jazz. I'm going to go see him.
Hi, kids. It's Pumpkinhead Harvey.
Pumpkinhead Harvey, Pumpkinhead Harvey. He comes alive when it's Halloween time. Pumpkinhead Harvey, Pumpkinhead.
Really?
Harvey.
Really?
Yes.
Yes? What is this?
Apparently you're not familiar with the appeal of Pumpkinhead Harvey.
No.
Who is a jack-o'-lantern.
Oh.
All right. And jack-o'-lanterns are what is happening during GLOW, a jack-o'-lantern festival.
Wow.
Carved Pumpkin Heaven, 4 to 10 o'clock, Friday and Saturday. Where else but Powell Gardens, walk a nearly mile-long path of glowing jack-o'-lanterns, and an expert pumpkin carver will be there to give you a few tips.
That's Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list with the assist from Steve Paul. Thanks very much.
And when I say you, I mean both of you guys are going to get pumpkin carving tips if you're brave enough to show up.
There you go.
All right.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, meet Lamont McIntyre, wrongfully imprisoned for 23 years. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.